BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with me, Tony Gosling, and Old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Coalition government taking away bedrooms at home while the EU does its best to steal money from little Cyprus bank accounts. Cypriot bailout. Will Angela Merkel's brinkmanship pay off? We talked to a leading finance blogger, Ian Fraser. Plus, Bob Ashford's here. He stood for Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner last November, but was told he couldn't because he'd been a naughty boy when he was a teenager. Also, a Syrian president-in-waiting is elected this week in Istanbul. And also rumours of chemical weapons being used in Syria. But by which side? As NATO makes tentative plans to invade Syria. That's Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We'll be talking to him about that and other world affairs after we speak to Ian Fraser, who should be joining me on the line now. Hi, Ian, can you hear me? Okay, yes, let's just turn you up a little bit. Ian, first of all, can you just tell us a little bit about your background as a financial blogger? I mean, I do follow a lot of your work, your posts, but what's your background?
Well, I was a financial editor of a newspaper here in Scotland called the Sunday Herald, where I worked from 1999 until 2006. And then I became freelance because I wanted, you know, to have more scope to do other things than just newspaper journalism. And since then I've done a number of BBC documentaries about the financial crisis, and I've basically worked with Bloomsbury, which is a publishing company, on a new project called Q Finance, which I helped to launch. I was the consulting editor, and there's a website, qfinance.com, which is linked to that. But yeah, mainly just freelance journalism, actually, writing about finance, economics, business, things like that.
Now, I mean, the first you came to my attention was about a year and a half, I think it was, maybe not so long as that ago, when you wrote what I thought was an excellent article about this County NatWest trial back in 1992, where several people were prosecuted, got suspended sentences for fraud, and then were somehow managed to get the Court of Appeal to overturn those. Can you just take us back to 92? Why was that trial so significant?
Well, the offence occurred in 87, which was basically a rigged rights issue for a company called Blue Arrow, which was a recruitment consultancy, a UK-based recruitment firm.
Okay, what is exactly a rights issue then?
Okay, well, that's when a company goes to the stock market and wants to raise capital from investors. So it puts together something called a prospectus, and it tells them what it's going to do with the money and persuades them that it's worth their while to give it the money in order to fund a particular type of activity. In this case, it was the acquisition of a US recruitment firm called Manpower that they needed the money for. They wanted to raise about £1 billion at the time.
They got suspended sentences, but they managed to get off. And I think you were saying, and certainly by looking at it, it looked like that the trial was kind of bogged, mired down with sort of annoying complexities.
So the reason why the individuals were tried was because they had basically made stuff up. They'd sort of they pretended that there was demand for the shares in the rights issue when in fact there wasn't any demand, or wasn't much demand for the shares in the rights issue, by buying them themselves using money from NatWest or County NatWest, which was who they worked for. But what happened was there was a one-year jury trial, which was obviously, you know, I think it was deliberately complexified or whatever. But at the end of that, four guys were given between 18-month and 2-year jail terms, suspended sentences. And that was in early 92, I think. And then in July 92, there was the results of an appeal court, court of appeal trial, which basically said they'd done nothing. Well, the verdict from that was that they were exonerated and had done nothing wrong. But I think what was quite interesting was that on the day of the result of that appeal court trial, a friend of mine who worked for the Metropolitan Police, I think, at the time, or he may have worked for one of the UK regulators at the time, received a call from a contact of his in the Serious Fraud Office, and the contact from the Serious Fraud Office said to him something along the lines of, the message has come down from on high. There will never again be a criminal prosecution of senior city people, and there will never again be a criminal prosecution of a mainstream city institution. That was what he was told by the person in the Serious Fraud Office on that day in July 92.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, there doesn't seem to have been much in the way. I mean, there have been some prosecutions, Ian, but they haven't really gone. I mean, we were talking earlier on, I did a little bit of research on the libel scandal, for example, that was going on for at least 4 years, and that the fine, out-of-court fine, that the RBS and Barclays settled was only the profits from about 1 week of those 4 years of LIBOR fraud.
I'm not sure if those figures are exactly right, but I mean, overall, there's a long-standing habit within UK financial services regulation to avoid criminal prosecutions, if at all possible. And I do think it does stem back to that 92 incident, which happened, obviously, under John Major. I think there's a long-standing preference for what could be deemed, you know, cosy backroom deals, where people will sort of agree never to work in the city again, as long as in exchange for the matter not being properly investigated, which is what has happened on a number of recent occasions. That there is a general kind of view, which I think. Actually, yeah, it's very interesting. If you look at the parliamentary debates around the time of Big Bang in 86, there's some very interesting debates going on in the Parliament, in the House of Commons at that point, with most of the Labour people aware that fraud was going on in the city, and most of the Conservatives either sort of not aware or wishing to just sort of pretend it wasn't really there. I think the habit of basically giving financial criminals an easy ride dates way back to probably 86 and Big Bang, and it was partly because, you know, Britain wanted to be seen as a place which was attractive to investment banks and the financial services sector generally, and where they could, you know, ply their trade in a relatively light touch environment, and where if there was wrongdoing, they wouldn't necessarily face very severe consequences.
Well, that certainly seems to have been what's transpired. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what's your thoughts about what Ian's saying here? Because he's suggesting that really Big Bang, mid-80s, late 80s, a green light went up saying, OK, guys, you know, the fraud is actually going to be OK. You know, massaging figures, accounts fraud, these kinds of rights issues, fraud during using those is okay. We're saying here that potentially that's been quite good for the country as a whole. In other words, good for London, in that it's given the city institutions free rein. But in the long term, maybe not so good.
No, and of course, if you get a reputation for being a cheat, people won't lend you their money ultimately. And of course, we're talking here about people like the Chinese and so on, saying, well, we're not going to give you our money because we don't trust you. And that ultimately will be what will undermine them.
Ian, have you got any examples of cases where you think over the last 10 years or so where, you know, other than, I mean, I've just mentioned the LIBOR, I mean, I'm staggered that still there's been no proper fraud prosecution for individual traders or for the directors of these banks for LIBOR. I mean,
well,
the
it's staggering. There is actually currently a tussle between the Department of Justice in the United States and I think it's the Serious Fraud Office here over one person who is seen as the Jesse James, inverted commas, of the global LIBOR conspiracy. He's a guy called, what's his name again? Sorry, I've forgotten his name. But he's an English guy, born in London, and I think it's something like Hayes. But anyway, the U.S. want to prosecute him. They want to extradite him and prosecute him in the U.S. But unfortunately, there's been some kind of... the sequence with which evidence has been given means that that's become difficult. And so it seems that he may not be extradited to the U.S. and that he may fall into the lap of the much softer Serious Fraud Office, which I'm sure would be to his benefit.
I mean, what's the point of the Serious Fraud Office in the 21st century, then, if it can't actually do these prosecutions?
Well, I don't know, but it's experience tells us that it's an utterly useless prosecutorial agency, and I think it should be disbanded because its track record has been fairly disastrous, especially when you think about the recent Chengguez fiasco, whereby, you know, it's being sued for £100 million by Robert Chengguez, the property developer. It's a disgrace.
Okay, that particular case, Ian, can you just go into that a little bit? Because I understand that they actually had him arrested for potentially, you know, investigating him for fraud, then decided to back off, at which point he then is now going for the Serious Fraud Office.
Well, that's right, because he thinks his reputation... I mean, he obviously claims that he's innocent, and he thinks the way in which they publicised the fact that he'd been arrested, and I think it was last year, was harmful to his personal reputation, which I'm sure it was, because, you know, the mere fact it's on the front page of every newspaper that he's been arrested and questioned by the SFO, I don't think he wasn't charged, is obviously negative. But he's the kind of... Well, I don't know how wealthy he is, but he's got a lot of borrowed money if he doesn't have any real assets. And so he is, he's now suing them. And, it would actually completely destroy them if he wins the case.
Interesting. I mean, I've just been looking up online, Ian, and found it's Thomas Hayes is the individual that the U.S. are trying to extradite.
That's actually the name, yeah. Thomas Hayes.
Thomas Hayes.
He's also known as Rain Man because he's apparently quite socially inept. But he was the guy... Well, what's quite funny about him is that all the banks claim they had absolutely no knowledge that LIBOR rigging was going on inside their institutions. You know, that's the line we've had from UBS, it's the line we've had from Barclays, it's the line we've had from Royal Bank of Scotland. The top guys, you know, claim they had absolutely no knowledge whatsoever that LIBOR rigging was happening. And yet, in the case of Tom Hayes, he was so brilliant at doing one thing and one thing alone, which was LIBOR rigging, that banks were prepared to, like, keep paying him more, to offer vast sums to hire him because they knew he was so brilliant at it. And they knew how he was making the money. They knew he was able to influence the LIBOR rate. And one example was Citigroup paid him a £5 million signing fee in 2009 when he joined them from UBS. So presumably they weren't just paying that because, you know, paying this guy a £5 million or dollar signing fee, if they thought he was just some kind of ordinary guy who was, you know, sitting around in the trading floor, not doing very much. They presumably were willing to pay him that because they knew he could move the LIBOR rate and therefore make them massive profits. Anyway, sorry.
It does seem a little bit strange, doesn't it, Martin, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers? It seems a little bit strange where you've got people during the riots arrested the year before last and last year arrested for, stealing a bottle of water for, I think it was 4 months, and then somebody who's perpetrating a billion pounds, you know, multi-billion pound fine fraud is then sort of still strutting around the streets of London, drinking in the bars, etc.
Yeah, well, somebody was sent down for stealing a gingerbread man who's just died in prison, actually, who's actually got mental illness issues. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the big bang should never have happened. with hindsight, we can see now that it was an absolutely stupid thing to do, and certainly the splitting of investment banking and retail banking, which was brought in the 30s, which was overturned in the early 90s, both here and in the US, that was also disastrous. And it's because these people have lobbied to be allowed to do what they want. And in the previous era, what they right-wing economists like to call financial repression was going on, which means basically they were told lots of things, they were told they couldn't do them, the sort of things they used to do in the run-up to the crash in 1929. And through the Second World War and afterwards, they were basically put in the box and told to behave themselves. But of course, they didn't like being in that box. They lobbied to get out of it, and Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan let them out. And of course, that's we are now reaping the whirlwind of those silly decisions.
Now, I mean, these fraudsters, Ian, I mean, they're probably only afraid of about three people. One is the police. The other is the financial press, really, basically doing deep investigations into them as individuals and exposing them. Yeah. And the other one is things like the parliamentary committees. I mean, do you think that there is any possibility of any of these three institutions coming to get them?
Well, I mean, there certainly has been a change in the regulatory approach since 2008. We had obviously the massive banking crisis in October 08, and it's sort of still going on to some extent. But, you know, the near failure of many of the world's leading institutions, including the narrowly averted failure of Royal Bank of Scotland, which at the time was the bank with the largest balance sheet on earth, $3 trillion in assets. And since then, it's fair to say that the regulators have slightly changed their approach. The FSA has gone after, to some extent, the institutions who rigged the LIBOR rate. So far, it's done three: Barclays, UBS, and Royal Bank of Scotland. And there's about another 17 in the offing of other large banks, including Lloyds and HSBC, which will have to make similar settlements with the FSA and its partners, who are the Department of Justice and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission in Washington.
But I mean, sorry to stop you there, Ian. Yeah. But as I pointed out earlier with these figures, which may be a little bit wrong, but I mean, I've looked at the amounts of the fines and the amounts of money being made in the LIBOR rigging. It isn't actually really a punishment, is it? If you're only fined, the amount of profit you've made one week over 4 years of crime.
Well, it speaks volumes that on the day that the Royal Bank of Scotland settled with these three regulatory authorities, its share price went up 8%. That is showing that investors believe it got off lightly, the fact that they marked up the shares by 8% on the day of the settlement. I think it was 8. So, yeah, no, the settlements are obviously totally inadequate and probably won't stop banks from misbehaving or manipulating interest rates or manipulating other market benchmarks. But it is a beginning. My overall view is the only way that you can root out serious wrongdoing from the financial markets and serious wrongdoing from the City of London is to really give, you know, proper to punish the individuals responsible, and also that they should take that right up to the top level, because in many instances the board directors were aware despite their denials. The only way that ultimately you can sort this out and root out the corruption is by having a powerful prosecutorial agency which goes after the villains. But we, at the moment, we do not have that.
What about the financial press? I mean, as a former finance editor for a national newspaper, what are your thoughts about the way the financial press has dealt with this? Because I must admit, I look at it and I sometimes think, well, maybe these guys are a little bit too close to the city.
You can certainly say that, and I think that this is a serious issue. You know, there are some good financial journalists. You know, there's a couple on the Wall Street Journal. There's, you know, one or two on the FT. There's then it begins to dry up a little bit. But yeah, I mean, basically, the tendency for financial journalists in this country is to be far too close to the institutions they're writing about, and to basically often just give the party line. You know, to be easily swayed by spin doctors or whatever, and not to do hard-edged investigations into what the banks, insurance companies, fund management companies, etc., are doing. And I think this is a serious problem. And actually, they're letting down their readers by taking this approach.
But it's a bit difficult to dish the dirt on someone when they're whining and dining you.
Well, that's the trouble. The banks are very clever. They do take the top journalists on jaunts to various things like horse racing or rugby matches or whatever, pop concerts, and they it's a way. It's not necessarily it's not direct bribery, but it certainly can make the journalists lose their scepticism when they're writing about that particular institution. I think that's very dangerous.
Well, one financial journalist I've got quite a bit of time for is Faisal Islam on Channel 4 News.
Yeah,
and so let's switch subjects a little bit now to Cyprus and hear his report on Sunday, where he's talking about really the Cypriot government feeling that they've been ambushed with a fait accompli.
It's a lose-lose situation. There will be a huge deposit withdrawal from Cypriot banks, with or without a deposit levy.
Cyprus suffered a German knockout. Chancellor Merkel, in German election year, was under huge pressure from the German opposition and her own coalition partners to limit any bailout of Cyprus. The concern that emerged in a 10-hour meeting in Brussels that ended in the early hours of yesterday was about the huge amount of deposits from wealthy Russians in the island's banks. Channel 4 News has been told how the Cypriot finance minister was basically ambushed with a threat to withdraw central bank support to Cyprus's banks from Tuesday and told to take it or leave it, i.e. leave the eurozone. In a statement published on his website, Cyprus's president of just 2 weeks says he came across a fait accompli, didn't want to choose the catastrophic scenario of disorderly bankruptcy, saying banks in crisis would cease to operate and paying out to depositors would cost 30 billion euros, which the state would be unable to pay, and that the service sector would be led to a complete collapse with a possible exit from the euro. Britain's long-standing historical connection with Cyprus includes military bases and expatriates.
Yes, yeah, so in a way, it's a kind of an attack on Brits. I mean, there's a lot of Brits with money in banks over in Cyprus. Anyway, what's your thoughts about this? Because this was a bit of a bombshell. It happened almost exactly a week ago.
Yeah. Yeah,
no coincidence, of course, because then it gives the markets no time to react for several days, 3 days, in fact, and more, obviously, in Cyprus, because of the bank holiday.
Yeah, the timing was perfect. There's echoes here to me, there are echoes of how the so-called Troika, which is the IMF, ECB, and EC, or EU, that's the European Union, the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, and the IMF in Washington. This so-called Troika, has held a number of countries to hostage since the financial crisis started, including Greece, Ireland, Portugal, etc. And when it imposes bailout packages on these nations, it's often they're often very draconian and require an austerity program to be introduced in as a condition for the loans. So, to me, yeah, there are definite echoes of that. And I wrote in May in May 2010 that the European Central Bank has in fact become Europe's feudal overlord. I said Europe faces a terrible future with the welfare socialism that characterized the post-war years being swept away and a possible return to European feudalism, according to economists Simon Johnson and Peter Boone. In a piece that was published in the Daily Telegraph in May 2010, Johnson, who's a former chief economist at the IMF, believe it or not, and a professor at MIT Sloan, said that the ECB is in fact Europe's new feudal overlord, and that its serfs and its vassals are countries and, of course, individual voters in those countries. Anyway, sorry, I could go on, but yeah, I mean, I think there's definite kind of sequence here the same sort of thing happened.
I mean, this is a little bit cheeky, isn't it? Because those feudal serfs are often, many of them are serving soldiers in the British Army in Cyprus, and many British expats. So it seems, even though Britain is not part of the Eurozone, a lot of Brits are getting hit, Martin.
Yes, and of course the other geopolitical problem is a lot of Russians are getting hit, including the Russian government, and they've immediately kicked off and said, look, this has been deliberately designed to take our assets. And of course you've got a geopolitical problem there. The Cypriot foreign minister, finance minister, is in Moscow, I believe, as we speak, negotiating.
No, he's
come back
home. There's no deal done with the Russians. No. He's come back home. But Ian, this is interesting. You're talking about feudalism, because some of the things on the table in Moscow apparently were natural gas assets, that is to say petrochemicals all around Cyprus, exploration rights for them, and also the possibly on the table a Russian naval base in Cyprus, which starts to look rather interesting when you compare it to the standoff that's going on in Syria.
Yeah, well, I guess it's sort of like quid pro quo, you know, we'll help you provided you basically become our servants, kind of thing, because that presumably a country like Cyprus is now totally on its knees and is going to be totally dependent for its survival on some sort of bailout, otherwise it will actually go bust. And so presumably that does mean there is a degree of bargaining power between Russia and the Troika over, you know, what they can get in return.
So what are your thoughts about what might happen next week? Because this is all, apparently the deal's got to be signed by Monday. If there is no deal, is it feasible for Cyprus to come out of the euro?
It's such a small country. I mean, someone was saying the other day it's like smaller than Detroit, and this was an American commentator, and they were claiming, you know, why could it have any macro impact if it's such a small place? But to be honest, I don't really know. I haven't been focusing on looking at Cyprus that closely because I've been doing some other stuff this week. So I don't know. I mean, okay. I guess if they do come out of the euro, it's going to be pretty grim. You know, their own currency is going to be subjected to massive inflation.
Well, one thing, at least they've got a plane load of euros from Britain, haven't they? I imagine their euros. We flew out loads of cash out there, didn't we? Martin, what are your thoughts about what might transpire next
week? Well, I understand that the Greek government has stepped forward and says they may help out the Cypriots. Where they're getting the money from is another question.
Well, yes, a big question.
But because, of course, what could happen here, the collapse of Kreditanstalt in 1933, I think it was, 3 years into the Depression, was the trigger for the major collapse. I fear that what's happened in Cyprus this week is like the shot at Sarajevo, because of course if Cypriot banks collapse and there's a disorderly exit from the euro, all these derivative contracts will come due, but people have bet against that, and I understand there's a massive bet being placed in the City of London that the euro will collapse in the next 2 weeks by somebody in the know. Now that of course is the nuclear moment, but this has been coming for the last 4 years. I mean, we've been living in a fool's paradise for 4 years presuming that they can carry on doing what they've been doing forever and that won't have consequences, and the consequences somewhere is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and it could well be Cyprus.
If there is a disorderly collapse of banks in Cyprus, obviously it's going to be really nasty for the Cypriots, but what's going to be the knock-on effect?
Well, lots of British banks will have bet on various aspects of this. I mean, you know, they'll have bet, you know, the people take out these credit default swaps against, you know, things that may happen, so they'll have bet that if Cyprus exits the euro, they will get paid, except they won't get paid because their counterparties will not have the money. Everybody will be chasing after their counterparties, nobody will be able to find them, and the derivatives market is massively bigger than the official banking system, and it will just swamp it in one go. It'll just be a bang.
I mean, that is quite an apocalyptic scenario that Martin's painting there.
It is an apocalyptic situation. Of course, the Russian, you know, this was coming for a while. It's not surprising.
I mean, it's fair to say, isn't it, Ian, that this is pretty unprecedented in Europe, anyway, in the Eurozone, for the Troika to go in there and say, right, we're going to shave off amounts from all of the bank accounts in your country.
It's the first time that they've actually gone for the depositors and you know, stolen or, you know, shaved off some of their deposits. So yeah, that was a first, and I think it was pretty ill-judged, you know, given what the possible consequences that Martin's outlining. The desire of the Germans to insist on this haircut was perhaps very, very misguided.
We did see a similar kind of thing, just with the IMF, back in Argentina. Many people lost money from their bank accounts in Argentina back in 2000. Is there anything to learn, Ian, do you think, from that?
Sorry, I'll have to pass on that one.
Martin?
I think the thing with Argentina was it was just them on their own, and they were able to put to do a very hard deal with the IMF, because if Argentina had defaulted properly, then that would have brought down the international banking system. Now Cyprus and Argentina's politicians had the grit, if you like, to negotiate.
It sounds to me what you're saying is that they've deliberately picked on little Cyprus because they know that Cyprus can't really fight back.
What that's leading to is a situation where they're saying, well, you promised that people with deposits up to 100,000 euros would be protected under any circumstances, and now it turns out that they're not. And of course, what you've done there is undermined confidence in the entire banking system across the EU. And yeah, it's not just individual EU banks and individual EU countries which will go down if you have a general financial crash. It could start in Cyprus and end in Tokyo within about 20 minutes.
Yeah, it does set a very dangerous precedent, because as soon as people lose faith in the money which they've actually, you know, deposited in a bank account, that's when you start getting runs on banks happening. And so, yeah, I think this is one of the dangers of the German insistence on the haircuts.
Now, Ian, we'll wind up in a second, but finally, I'm just going to ask you with a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, possibly. If you were in this, one of these people in control of the Troika, maybe, you know, the German finance minister or somebody like that who had some influence, what would you be suggesting to get Europe out of this? Because it does seem that we're in a death spiral, and I say that word deliberately, death spiral here, where these debts are never going to be paid off. At least the Cypriots have recognised there's no point in borrowing more money because they'll never be able to pay it off. They're not prepared to kick that can down the road. What would you be doing as a European banker to try and get round this situation? I mean, is it at all feasible that there could be, rather than a disorderly collapse of these banks, that could be done in some kind of orderly fashion and these debts could be cancelled?
I think a lot of the people in charge of the Bundesbank who have huge influence over the ECB lack political antenna. And they are kind of very rigidly focused on keeping inflation in check and that sort of thing, and sustaining the value of the euro. And I think they just need to have a different mindset, which is more aware of the human angle, you know, to all of this. But yeah, it is difficult. I mean, basically, the euro, with the benefit of hindsight, has been a disaster, and it's enabled a lot of the so-called peripheral nations, or, you know, the Club Med nations, sometimes called, to basically build up far more debt than they could service. Because there was this common assumption that if they did ever get into trouble, you know, dear old Germany would come to their rescue.
Rather than stab them in the back.
There was quite a difference. You know, there was that assumption during the good years, you know, so-called good years, or the credit bubble years of from 1999 through to 2008. But yeah, now Germany's coming to stab them in the back, and it's not the right approach. But the overall thing is there's a lot of debt which presumably does need to be repaid. So you got to find ways.
I mean, surely,
that.
I mean, the Cypriots are saying that we recognise we will never be able to repay this.
Well, we, the UK.
No, the Cypriots have said, we will never be able to repay this debt, so we need to have I suppose we're talking about another little island, aren't we, up in the north of the Atlantic, Iceland, that kind of attitude.
Yeah, well, maybe that is the Icelandics had the right approach of just defaulting and then, you know, making the most of the fallout, and they seem to have had a far better recovery than almost any other of the seriously affected nations. But,
In fact, in a way, this comes back to what we were talking about earlier about arrests as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, obviously the Cypriots can't do that unless they leave the euro, so they have to leave the euro first, and then they'd have to see if they could pursue an Icelandic solution. What's the arrest got to do with it?
Well, I was just saying that, that's what we were talking earlier on about, arrests within the eurozone, you know,
yeah,
at least in the city of London too. That seems to have worked for the Icelandics.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, and actually Nigeria, I don't know how well it's worked in Nigeria, but they arrested and imprisoned about 100 of the chief executives and other top directors of their banks in the wake of the banking crisis of 2008. And I don't know how well or badly that's impacted on their banking sector. But yeah, arrests, they definitely are if there is crime, and there is strong evidence to suggest that there was quite widespread crime, in libel is probably just the thin end of the wedge, then I think it's essential that the people get arrested, prosecuted, tried, and then jailed if appropriate.
Okay, Ian Fraser, former National Newspaper finance editor, and your blog is at ianfraser.org. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time tonight.
Okay.
Drive Time on BCFM
93.2. Now we're joined by Bob Ashford. Hi, Bob. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Thank you for being very patient there. We weren't sure that we were going to have a top financial journalist on the week of this this incredible Cyprus scandal. Now, you stood back in November, didn't you? Or at least before November, yes. To be one of the candidates for Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner. Can you just tell us a bit about your background?
I have been a Labour councillor. That was probably 15 years ago. I was a Labour mayor in Frome. And I was also a parliamentary candidate in 97 and in 93, I think it was, in Somerton and Frome. So I've been a Labour Party member for the last 25, 30 years, I guess. But I was actually coming from the post, not so much, I was the Labour candidate, but I'd also had a long career, in the criminal justice system. And I saw these posts coming along, and I know the Labour Party and myself were actually against, against the introduction of them. But given they were going to be created, these posts, and I could see the influence they were going to have and the budgets they were going to hold, and particularly in the area of work, which I'd been involved in, which was youth justice, I could see that police and crime commissioners were going to take on board and be responsible for many of the budgets for youth crime, for victims, domestic violence, etc., etc., which previously, those budgets had been held by community organisations. And I was really concerned, particularly in Avon and Somerset, that if the wrong candidate were elected, then those budgets and those priorities could be quite different to the ones which had taken place earlier. And I thought I could bring the experience that I had after working for, 25 years in the criminal justice system and in children's services to bear on that particular post.
So what were you actually doing in the criminal justice system? Because there's been a lot of criticism of some of the candidates around the country, some of whom have been elected successfully, who are former policemen themselves.
Yeah, well, I'm a qualified social worker to begin with. I served as a social worker probably for 10, 15 years. I was a social services manager. I then became, in 97, one of the first youth offending team managers in the country with the introduction of the Crime and Disorder Act. I started, built, created a youth offending team in Wiltshire and was responsible for that. After 3 years, I then moved to the Youth Justice Board for England and Wales, which is a national organisation which gives grants and sets policy and strategy for the youth justice system. I was head of prevention there when I joined, and when I finished there last year, I was director of strategy at the Youth Justice Board. I'd had meetings with ministers, I'd set national policy, I'd had meetings in Number 10, I'd been Home Office security vetted. I was actually working at probably one of the highest levels in terms of the youth justice system in this country. So again, I thought I could actually bring that experience that I had to this particular post.
Well, tell us about that on the ground, though. I mean, what does it actually mean for a young offender? And I mean, what were your thoughts about how best to deal with, particularly, say, teenagers who've been offending and maybe on the borderline between having adult responsibility for those crimes?
Well, I've spent nearly all my career actually talking to young people about the need for them to stop offending and be rehabilitated. And the message that I've always given them is if you stop committing crime, there is another way, and society will forgive you, and there will be opportunities for you. And my sort of work has been, in many ways, really, both, being, if you like, sort of tough on crime. If people commit offences, then they have to be punished.
What would you say when those young people come back to you and they say, actually, there are very few opportunities for us? And maybe out of a selection of 5 or 6 young people, a couple will have good opportunities. At least there'll be a few that simply won't get jobs because there aren't jobs out there for them.
Well, that's right. And I would have to agree with that. But what I'd also say is it right that someone, because they've committed a criminal offence, particularly children, young people, teenagers, is it right that that offence should be a bar to employment, which it is for those people throughout their adult life? And I would say that's wrong. That's totally wrong.
I mean, what about this sort of temptation, particularly here in Bristol, that there is for young people to actually just get involved with organised crime, doing drug dealing when they can't get a job?
Sure. I mean, that you know, that's a reality, really, and it's a tough one to actually beat with young people, because, you know, when you're trying to tell them on the one hand, you know, you need to stop committing crime and you need to get, you know, you need to find employment, we'll help you with that, training, education, etc., and they know that they can actually, you know, go down the road, sell some drugs and get some easy money. It's a difficult one to break, and it becomes even harder when they know that even if they decide to actually stop committing crime, the opportunities for them are actually thwarted because of the criminal convictions that they have, and society, and we as a society, are actually unable to, not wanting to actually allow them to rehabilitate and to accept them as full members of society. It's bad for them, it's bad for us.
So tell us about the day when I suppose it was October roughly or something like that, where you were told, sorry Bob, you can't stand to be Police and Crime Commissioner.
Yeah, it was actually August, and there'd been a period leading up to that when I'd obviously been selected as a Labour Party candidate, and I'd started a campaign, and I was already out there having meetings, hustings, etc., etc., getting literature together. And the process of actually sort of realising that I couldn't stand had probably taken place over about a month before that. And there was a lot of confusion around police and crime commissioners and who could stand, who were barred, etc. And both the Home Secretary and the Attorney General, so Theresa May and the Attorney General, had both said that the barring legislation, i.e. people that couldn't stand because of imprisonable offences, didn't apply to offences committed by young people, as young people. So I thought, okay, this doesn't apply to me. And then there was a sort of sequence of events, really. First of all, Simon Weston, who's a sort of, you know, the Falklands hero, he was standing as an independent candidate in South Wales, and he resigned and said that he couldn't, you know, that he could no longer stand as a candidate. And at the time, he said it was really around, he was saying that the whole posts were becoming too political. But there was also a kind of strong undercurrent that it was also because that he had committed an offence as a young person. So he resigned, and then there was a sequence of events which is too complicated to go into, but I realised that in fact I could not stand that legislation said that anyone who has committed an imprisonable offence is barred from becoming a police and crime commissioner. Now, imprisonable offences, most offences are imprisonable, i.e. one could go to prison for that particular offence if you were a serial committer of that particular offence.
Except fraud, of course.
Yes. Well, I've just been listening to that debate. It's really interesting, actually, isn't it? Yeah, except fraud, where, you know, you can commit offences for millions of pounds and, as you say, still drink in the wine bars of London and internationally.
And don't even go to court. This amazes me. Anyway, yeah, sorry. Back to the real world, from this crazy world of the city. And so you actually realised, gosh, you know, the legislation says that I can't stand.
Yeah, and I mean, just before that, I was actually looking at the kind of process through Parliament of the legislation and reading the debates which had taken place both in Parliament and in committee, and became, I guess, sort of fairly surprised by the lack of knowledge that had taken place during that debate. Because I firmly believe that politicians on all sides had no intention of stopping people like myself in terms of the, you know, convictions that long ago from standing. But what they were talking about was stopping people who had what they were referring to as serious offences committed as young people from becoming police and crime commissioners at 18 or 19, which would have been possible, yeah, before. So when they talked about serious offences, they were sort of conflating seriousness with imprisonable offences, which is completely, if you know anything about the justice system, that's complete nonsense. And they also paid no attention to the length of time which had taken place, you know, which had happened before the person wanted to stand as a police.
It does rather sound like it was rushed through legislation, doesn't it?
The whole legislation is absolutely fraught, and the report which has come out this week from the Electoral Commission, I mean, says just that, really.
We had this amazing situation in Newport, didn't we, where nobody actually voted in one
absolutely
of the wards.
Yeah.
Incredible. Anyway, tell us about what you did do.
Okay.
You fess up now, Bob.
Okay, absolutely. I've no problem with that whatsoever. And what I did, I was born in Bristol. I went to Fonthill Junior Mixed School in Southmead. I was born in Southmead Hospital. I lived on an estate, Henbury, council estate in Henbury, where I was sort of brought up. Went to Henbury Comprehensive School. When I was 13, I sort of knew a lot of lads in the area, some good kids, some not so good, you know. And one night when I was 13 years old, there was a knock on the door, and I opened it, and there in front of me were a group of lads, some of whom I knew and some of whom I didn't really want to know, quite frankly, but they were there, and they said, "Do you want to come out?" And I said, first of all, no, but then they kind of persuaded me, so along I went. And in those days, I mean, in terms of where you know, and now, where kids played, we went to a railway embankment, which was a local railway embankment, barely used, and it's where you went, where you played as kids. And when we got there, one of these lads pulled out an air gun, and which are, you know, and it sounds pretty heinous, but in those days, I mean, air rifles, air guns were, you know, if you like, the weapon of choice. They were widely used by young people in back gardens for shooting practice, all the rest of it. So one of them brought this out, and I knew at the time, I thought, God, this isn't good. But I stayed there because the kind of pressure, peer pressure and everything else. And this lad started firing off its sort of cans and things. And before I knew it, along came the sort of transport police over the horizon. And most of the kids scarpered, but I was sort of rooted to the spot, terrified, and myself and two others were actually then arrested by the police. And the next thing I remember is them coming to the house where my parents were and I was, and them having a discussion in one room, you know, my parents and the police in one room, them coming into the next room and telling me to sign these bits of paper. And as I did, I was a nice kid. So I signed these bits of paper, which in effect were admissions of guilt, both for trespassing on the railway embankment and possession of an offensive weapon.
Now, I mean, I know what lads are like, 13-year-olds, they all want to go on the air gun, don't they?
Yeah.
Did you actually fire this thing?
No, I didn't, know. Never touched it. I never touched it because there was a large group of lads there. And like I say, the kid had the gun, it was his gun. So he wasn't going to let anybody else near it, you know, it was his. So no, never touched it.
Okay, so what exactly did you sign? Just remind us there. You signed.
This was a statement that said I was guilty of both offences, even though I wasn't. And again, you know, it was common then, and it's still common today, where everyone wants to sort of, you know, get the thing out of the way, get it over with, get people to sort of fess up to things, get it to court, get it finished, get it done with. So that was the kind of message, really, and that's what I did. I then went to court. And again, terrifying experience. Never been to court before. Never been to court since for offences, anyway. And was fined £2.10 on each offence, and told off by the magistrates. And was mortified at the time, as my parents were, you know, for actually me being in court. And then I guess I forgot all about it after a while, as you do, because that was the message again. You know, you do this, you get punished, you get over with, you get on with your life. And so I did. And I left school, I went to work, worked in a factory first of all, then I went to a film technical college, got some qualifications, went to university.
Well, and you've then, never been in court since. I mean, that's fantastic. The problem is now, I mean, for the next lot of police and crime commissioner elections, is it still the same?
Yes.
So you won't be able to stand at all for this post.
Well,
because the thing that shocks me is that, and having done a little bit of research about this back in November, is that there were messages going around the country in national news stories explaining that some of the senior police officers, this is literally the top three tiers, chief constables, assistant chief constables, hadn't even been vetted for their jobs.
That's right. And in fact, many police officers have imprisonable offences and are still police officers at every level. So, you know, it was completely wrong, ridiculous, to just single out police and crime commissioners. But again, I say it was the law of unintended consequence. I really don't believe that they actually intended this to be the case, because I could be the Prime Minister, I could be the leader of the United Nations, I could be the chief of the European Central Bank, you know, I can be a chief constable, but I can't be a police and crime commissioner because of this barring events. But what's happened since is quite interesting, really, because at the time I resigned, there was sort of one body of opinion which said you should resign, go quietly, you know, then people will forget about this after a while. But my reaction to that was absolutely no way. This isn't about me. This isn't about police and crime commissioners. This is about the way that we treat young people, particularly.
So people
that have criminal convictions.
Are you getting anywhere to changing the principle, the legal principle?
We are indeed, yeah. I mean, the first thing I did was to start a campaign called Wipe the Slate Clean. We have a website, wipetheslateclean.org.uk. On that website, you will see case studies, our campaign messages, etc., etc. So, and the campaign has been about several things, really. First of all, it's about trying to change the law around police and crime commissioners and the barring legislation that applies to that. But it's also, and probably more importantly, is trying to actually devise a new system whereby offences that are committed by young people, and minor offences to begin with, are actually wiped clean from people's records when they reach the age of 18. Those offences, you know, offences committed by children, minor offences, should not be an encumbrance on their future careers and future lives. And the other thing we're trying to do is to ensure that when people actually are offered cautions by the police, now these are cautions are things which happen if you don't go to court, cautions happen, and what tends to happen is that the police say to young people, if you accept a caution, you don't have to go to court, this will all be wiped clean, you know, people will forget about it, etc. Most people don't even realise that a caution's a criminal conviction. So there has to be, at that point that people are offered cautions, the police have to set out absolutely clearly the long-term implications of what could happen with that caution.
I mean, it sounds nice, this wipe the slate clean, but isn't that encouraging youngsters to just go committing as much crime as they can as teenagers, because they know that once they get to adulthood, I mean, they're not stupid. No. They could do those crimes knowing that once they get to a certain age, it's all gone.
No, they've been punished. I mean, that's the important thing. I was punished. You know, I was punished and I served my punishment. And I was rightly punished. And young people will be rightly punished. But, you know, it's ridiculous for those offences to actually be maintained throughout their adult life. And it's not just me saying this, because since then, we've had the Court of Appeal decision in January. So Lord Dyson, Court of Appeal, similar situation. Young person who'd committed an offence as a child, was applying to go to university and was actually asked to disclose his criminal convictions. That case was taken through the courts by Liberty, and the Court of Appeal have now said to the Home Office, this is ridiculous, you have to do something about that. Just last week, the Home Affairs Select Committee, which is a cross-party group of MPs, also said, Home Office, legislators, this situation is ridiculous. Most minor offences should be wiped clean at the age of 18. So there's a real kind of momentum going now to get this in place, which is great.
Okay, Bob. Finally, we're going to have a listen now to Marina Morris, who's been out on the streets this week, just talking about asking you actually about what you think and when you have confidence in our police.
Do people have confidence in the police?
I appreciate the police for the job that they do, but am I 100% confident in them? No, I'm not. Reason for that, they're human beings like anybody else. I think they do a good job that they do, and they are needed, they are essential, but I'm not 100% confident in them.
I personally do, yeah. They've not really done anything to put them in a negative light, in my personal opinion. With like the recent riots that we had in the last year, I mean, there was a lot of issues surrounding how the police dealt with that, and whether there was a show of force, and whether they were enforcing their power too much. But personally, I have no problem with the police, and I have a complete confidence in them as a unit.
Whenever I've dealt with the police, they've always been like sort of decent, polite, good manner people, really. I mean, obviously there is a negative connotation. Some people think they sort of go in too much.
I do have confidence to a certain degree in the police.
Yes, I do. Yes. I just think they're there when you need them.
I'm from Kent. I think we are quite content with our police in Kent. What happens in Bristol, I have not a clue.
What do you think about investigations in the phone hacking and Jimmy Savile?
Jimmy Savile, that was like terrible, and like, that's like chasing the arse while the gate's already like open. I mean, Jimmy Savile's thing should have been dealt with when he was alive. It's a pity for all his victims and the people that he hurt. And for the phone hacking with the MPs, it's disgraceful. They should know better, really. They should know better. In this day and age, people's privacy is more and more essential to them and important. And to have people prying, especially MPs or people you vote in to protect you, that's terrible mistrust. And that goes back to the police thing and confidence. Things like that don't help with confidence in police and people of authority.
What, into like celebrities getting their phones hacked? I think it's a bit of an intrusion on their personal life. Obviously, investigative journalism, they're always trying to find means of how they can get a scoop and a scandal. I think that it's just a precaution that everyone needs to take, really, and something that can happen to anybody, whether you're in the public eye, if you're a celebrity, or if you're just in the media, you can always get your phone hacked. It's a common thing that happens, I think.
I mean, they don't really appreciate that celebrities are people too, so I think they sort of went a bit too far with the phone hacking. Like you said, it's an invasion of privacy. It really does undermine the trust in the media, really.
It wasn't just celebrities, it was like politicians as well. So I mean, it's sort of, it's a breach of your own personal space. Human rights and personal space. Yeah, definitely.
Well, it was a cover-up, wasn't it, with Savile, and a lot could have been done in a lot shorter time. And it's just a bit of a shame nothing can be done now because it's too late, he's dead.
Jimmy Savile should have been investigated a long time ago.
I'm surprised that so many people didn't come forward before. It seems an awful long time since someone must have known, even, I may say, even Esther Ranson, who holds forth about all the things that should have happened. You cannot tell me that after all these years, nobody knew something was going on. And the same would go with all the other things that are going on.
That was you and your views there, collected by Marina Morris out on the streets of Bristol. And you heard before that from Bob Ashford, whose website again is www.wipetheslateclean.org.uk.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Finally tonight, Syria, Martin. We've had two big stories. One is Gassan Hito has been elected over in Istanbul as the president-in-waiting of Syria by various various opposition groups, and also chemical weapons.
Well, he's been elected by nobody, really. He's just been appointed by his Western backers. Chemical weapons have been used, everybody's saying that. The Russians and the Syrians say it's the rebels. The rebels say it's the other side. It's going to be, it's looking like an excuse for war, isn't it?
More, yes. And I notice also that NATO is planning an invasion plan right now. The other big news this week, of course, is curveball and the 10 years since the Iraq invasion. This is a German agent that everyone trusted.
Yes, and of course we were lied to then and we're still being lied to now.
Okay, Martin, thank you. Time to sign off now. Friday night, typical topical Afro-tropical show is next. 955-3721 to join Cyrus the Virus. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Eastville Councillor for Lib Dems, Steve Comer. Thanks to Ian Fraser and to Bob Ashford. Thisweek.org.uk is our website, and you can follow my Twitter feed in between shows at Tony Gosling. This is Tony Gosling wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and see you next week.
Community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, forecasters are